Okay, so I thought I will. We heard very nice talks on both the neutrino oscillation experiments and cosmology. I thought I'd just bring in a third field now in the terms of the ultra high energy cosmic rays and how that's. I'm a cosmologist, so how we actually. What was the relevance? So that's the neutrino clustering part. So in order to motivate, so our work was motivated by the ultra high energy particle cosmic ray field. So I'll start by talking, review very briefly about that, and then the neutrino clustering part will come in. So here is a cosmic ray energy spectrum, flux times E cubed over 10 decades in energy of the cosmic rays. This is from the review paper by Nagano and Watson, and showing the characteristic, these very known, well-known features in the cosmic ray spectrum. Here's the Ni at about 10 to the 15th EV, the ankle a few times 10 to the 18th, and you see the spectral slope changes somewhat, and I think people multiply by that by E cubed just to accentuate the change in the slope. And clearly something's going on at the very, very high energy part above about 4 times 10 to the 19th EV, that's referred to as the ultra high energy cosmic ray part. And so something's going on there. So, and I'll show you a plot later, the next plot show you concentrating on that part. And there are many theories, many experiments going on, and the origins of these cosmic rays, propagation, acceleration, very rich field. And each part, it starts from the solar region to galactic, to probably somewhere going to extragalactic sources, and then the mysterious ultra-high energy cosmic ray part. Okay, so I'll just, for the rest of the talk, I'll concentrate on the very highest energy regime. So for the upper two decades, this is from the one of the many papers have been written about this, and a very recent compilation by DeMarco, Blasi, and Olinto, again showing you the same flux times E cubed, but now it's from 18.5 EV to 10 to the 20.5. And this is the well-known sort of two very large collaborations, experiments, the Japanese Agassa Water Cherenkov experiment versus the Utah Hi-Res fluorescence experiment. And there has been some discrepancy, dispute going on lately. This paper made the point that the discrepancy is at only about 2 sigma level. Okay, and people discuss whether this Hi-Res point seemed to be seemed to agree with what's called the GZK feature, which I'll describe in the next view graph, and Agassa seems to see excess above the GZK prediction. So from at least based on this paper, that 2 sigma discrepancy is there, and the hope right now is on the ongoing OJ experiment, which has started taking data, they have both water Cherenkov and fluorescence channels. So hopefully, perhaps some sort of energy calibration problem in one or both experiments will be hopefully will be sorted out. Okay.
At the low energy part, say the low 10 to the 19, it looks like the difference is more than 2 sigma.
Yeah, that's right. I think this paper made the point that if you slide around, they claim that you can actually also explain that. But I'll refer you to the paper. Okay. So from now on, I'll concentrate on the 19.5-ish and above.
What does slide around mean?
So in terms of energy calibration.
So just move the curves horizontally?
Right. And then there seems to be also an overall amplitude.
Well, because of the EQ, so it goes up.
Right, right. That's right. So you don't do that. Okay. All right. So about the GZK cutoff, as you notice, this was pointed out shortly after the first discovery of the CMB. And the point here is very energetic protons would scatter off the cosmic microwave backgrounds and go into a delta plus star resonance and will lose energy through photo-ion production, among other reactions. So these energetic protons, however they were produced, won't propagate very far. So there is a sort of characteristic sphere, what's called the GZK zone, okay, about 130 megaparsec. Within that, all the particles above 4 times 10 to the 19th must come within that sphere. Now, the sphere gets smaller and smaller as you look at higher and higher energy particles. When you raise this to 10 to the 20th eV, the zone becomes about 20 megaparsec. And there are various theories about how you could accelerate proton to such a high energy. And most of them, or some of them, rely on astrophysical sources such as active Galactic nuclei. And there are very few of them known within this GZK zone. So that's the mystery. What is the origin of these events? For the rest of the talk, I will concentrate on one of the theories for these super GZK events. And that's called the Z-burst model, and in fact was first proposed by Tom Weiler. And that was actually, I think your paper was written, the first paper was 20 years ago, but the connection to the cosmic ray was pointed out several years ago. Okay, so this is one of the models for explaining these super GZK events. And in some ways, this is one of the most conventional models in the sense that it doesn't require physics beyond the standard model of particle physics, except for neutrino masses. Okay, and this very elegant model uses neutrinos. And so here, it assumes that if we have a source of some high-energy neutrino, then it could scatter off the cosmic background neutrino, which is just slightly cooler than the cosmic background photon by well-known ratio. In fact, the temperature today is 1.97 something Kelvin for the background neutrinos. And the interesting thing is this resonant energy here. This is the energy of the high-energy neutrino and the rest mass of the relic neutrino. And this is you could go through the Z0 boson resonance scattering, and 70% of the time we'll get a hadronic shower. And this resonant energy just happens to be a few times 10 to the 21 eV for a 1 eV neutrino, and it's inversely proportional to that. And because it's a resonance scattering, the cross-section is much enhanced, therefore making it this a non-negligible event. So the cartoon here is that we're at the center, and there's sort of a GZK zone of about on the order of 50 megaparsec. So we use neutrinos to carry the energy in, and then if the Z burst occurs, the new bar scattering occurs within this GZK zone, then you can go through Z0 and then get the nucleons, which will subsequently come into the upper atmosphere and trigger the shower. So we don't have problem with the GZK cutoff because these bursts happen within the zone, so the energy loss is much less. Okay, now it seems that every theory for ultra high energy cosmic rays has a tooth fairy in it, and I'll say for this model, the tooth fairy is the origin of these neutrinos. As you see, that here you see, in order to have this event happening for sub-EV events, we need energetic neutrinos of a few times 10 to the 21 eV. And theories have been proposed. I think some authors, Kusenko and Gelmini, have written papers about how to produce these neutrinos. Right now, it's uncertain, and there is not one single model that's obvious. Okay, so that's the tooth fairy here. But assuming that if you have a source like that, then this process is very interesting. You can actually produce super GZK events this way. Okay, so in the previous work on this topic, most of the papers assume that this relic neutrino is just a smooth, homogeneous relic. It has no clustering in the spatial density of the relic neutrinos. And what we did was we said, well, let's examine that. How true is that? That is to say, do neutrinos cluster now that we know their masses, roughly, the range of the masses. Okay, yeah.
Doesn't it put a higher limit now on neutrino mass? I mean, you have the higher mass of neutrino to explain those events after 10 to 19. Because that's 10 to 21.
Right, so you need actually even higher energy if you want the smaller than 1 eV.
Right, so there will be some gap. I mean, we cannot understand any event in between.
Well, that's the source.
This is the source, the energy of this neutrino, and then you can calculate what the subsequent proton energy will be from this well-known interaction, and then I'll show you our prediction, and you can predict the proton, the cosmic ray energy spectrum. Okay. Okay. So what we set out doing was, okay, let's ask, do neutrinos cluster, or if they do, how much? Because that's obviously relevant for this problem. Okay, so here's just a few characteristic numbers for the universe. Okay, if you just take the Fermi-Dirac distribution, which is good to zeroth order, then the mean neutrino velocity is 160 kilometers per second today for one EV neutrino, and goes inversely proportional to that. And this is the free streaming thing we were talking about earlier. Okay, now compare that to, say, Virgo cluster, that's one of the largest cluster in the nearby universe. A Virgo cluster has many, many galaxies, thousands of galaxies and clusters of galaxies in there. And the total velocity dispersion of the potential well is more than 1,000 kilometers per second. So roughly you can see already, and remember, this is a broad Fermi-Dirac distribution. This is just the mean. So there are plenty of neutrinos that are slower than that speed. So it's possible that they cluster on the Virgo scale. You look at our own Milky Way, then the velocity dispersion is on the order of 200 to 300. Then given the current neutrino mass of sub-1 eV, most of them, you don't expect them to be caught, captured in the potential well that well. Okay, so this is a rough order of magnitude. So we wanted to calculate this better. So probably the most straightforward way, but the brute force way to do this is to just do n-body cosmological simulations. That has been done very well for quasar matter type of particles, and we know that our universe has just a sprinkle of neutrinos in it. So the potential, the clustering properties of these objects are all controlled by the quasar matter. Okay. And that is the answer to the earlier discussion about free streaming distance. Although neutrino free streaming distance definitely scales as 1 over the mass, the clustering property really is controlled by quasar matter. That's why it doesn't make as much difference on the linear power spectrum Scott showed. Okay, and you'll see that later too. Okay, so since the universe is dominated by the quasar matter, we realized that we actually didn't have to do n-body simulations. And also our interest here is in over a wide range of neutrino masses, and we want to study things from galaxies, different halo masses for Virgo, 10 to the 15th solar masses, down to the 10 to the 12th solar masses. N-body, high resolution n-body will be very, very time consuming to do. And we realized that we didn't have to do that. In fact, we could actually use the Boltzmann equation written here. So here, neutrinos are collisionless particles. So here, F is a phase-based distribution for neutrinos. And this is just the collisionless Boltzmann equation, Vlasov equation. Okay? And typically, what makes life extremely complicated is this gradient of phi, where in normal situation, your phi would be determined by your F. So that's a highly nonlinear equation. And n-body is one way to do Monte Carlo of this equation. Okay? But in our situation, in fact, life is a little easier. So to proceed, I could write F separately as a smooth part plus a cluster part. Okay, so F background and F cluster, and same thing for the potential. And I know very well how the background part works, the smooth part works, because that's for neutrinos, it's just Fermi-Dirac. T nu 0 is the neutrino temperature today. And the background potential is just related to rho bar, the mean density of the universe, Freeman, Robertson, Walker universe, very well known. So my goal now is to solve for F and phi. And this is a work in that I did with one of my graduate students, Shwetop Singh at Berkeley. So what we did was, well, you can just put this in here, and we know using the Friedman equation, some of these terms cancel. So that top equation becomes this equation. There's no approximation made at all here. Okay, so eta is just another time variable. Q is the momentum, m nu is neutrino mass. And here, and this is for F clustered. Okay, so key here is the phi clustered. And this is what made our life much easier, is because phi cluster is largely determined by the quadar matter. And in fact, that's well known. And so the Poisson equation relates phi cluster to theoretically fluctuation in the quadar matter and in the neutrinos. But this term is proportional to omega in nu, and this is proportional to omega in CDM. And we know omega nu is much smaller than omega CDM. So in fact, the contribution from this term is tiny. Okay? And baryons, in fact, we don't model the difference in baryons. It's very small, too. So all the baryon budget is lumped into the omega, the rho CDM here. So, and this term is known very well from, thanks to other people's high-resolution n-body simulations. And in cosmology, right now there's a very useful approximation for the density profiles of quadar matter halos, and I'll show you it shortly. Okay, so this term is known very well with a simple analytical term given to us. So all we ask right now is, given that there are these quadar matter halos going around, and given that neutrinos are not likely to affect them, however, the evolution of the quadar matter obviously controls the evolution of the neutrinos. So we have this term here. Knowing that term, then this equation actually is linear in F. I'm not making any approximation here yet, okay? And so it's actually solvable without using n-body simulations. So just briefly about this term, the universal halo profile for the quadar matter. This is taken from a simulation by Jin and Suto. So here all you're seeing is quadar matter simulation particles, no neutrinos. And they showed there are 12 simulated halos on galaxy scale, 10 to the 12th solar masses-ish, 10 to the 13th, and 10 to the 14th. So these are about galaxy groups, and these are galaxy clusters scale. And these are just four realizations of halos. You see a lot of interesting substructure, and that's one of the active debate in quadar matter theory today, is whether these substructures cause problem in comparison to observations. But I won't go into that in this talk. The key here is that each simulation has a little more than a million particles within a single halo. Okay, so it's a pretty, very powerful high-resolution simulation.
How many galaxies are contained in the
picture? Right, so this is, it depends on how you identify them. Each one probably has at least hundreds of them. Okay. And these are seen, clusters are seen to have many hundreds of galaxies, but these substructures are what's not seen in galactic, like in the Milky Way. Our satellites, we see only about 24 of them. But simulations see hundreds to 1,000, and that's for the so-called substructure problem that I was referring to. But having these, you can then calculate the density profile of the dark matter halos. And this is for the same 12 halos earlier on. So this is the density versus radius from the center of each halo. And they took spherical averaging. And I think they displace each curve by a factor of 10 just for clarity. Okay, so the key here is the density goes like, sort of this is a very, seems to be a very good approximation for the profile of quadar matter. And the 1996-97 paper by Navarro, Frank, and White, the Munich Simon White's group, they show that p equal to 1, it seems to be a good fit. That is to say, the slope goes about r to the minus 1 here and steepens to about r to the minus 3 for the outer part. And this is so-called universal profile. It doesn't seem to matter what mass scale you're talking about. It doesn't matter what cosmological model you're looking at. This simple form seems to work extremely well. lately there have been some discussion about the cuspiness of the inner profile, whether it's 1 or 1.5. Okay, and it seems to depend a little bit on the resolution and so on. But on the outer part, r to the minus 3 seems like a good fit. Okay, this is for pure coder matter model. And I'll just add at this point that the origin of this profile is very ill, is not understood well at all. Why would coder matter know to fall into this kind of form universally? It's an intriguing unsolved question. And my collaborator Ed Birchner and I, we've been trying to come up with a kinetic theory to explain this nature of why does this happen. But that's a sigh. Okay. So the point here is, so this is good for the CDM, dark matter. So our question was then, assuming that neutrinos don't affect the structure of these guys much, we ask, then how would neutrinos cluster, okay, on different scales using that Boltzmann equation, as you saw?
Okay. And if that leads to, homogeneity problems, right, in these subclusters that are much more numerous than what one sees, and similarly the p-dependence, how is that going to propagate through and affect your results?
Right, I'll show you the substructure. Since we're doing spherical averaging, that's just lost. We're not even addressing how, in fact, on such a small scale, neutrinos are unlikely to cluster at all. Okay, so you should think of this as being a nice, smooth CDM halo we're putting into our model. The inner profile, I'll show you later, actually next slide, it doesn't matter too much because neutrinos are doing something different at the center. Okay, so that Boltzmann equation is what we solved for the neutrinos using this potential. And the solution actually turned out, I'll skip through the math, but the solution actually turned out to be a Volterra integral, which we can just solve. And taking d3v of the phase space distribution gives us the overdensity of the neutrinos. So we didn't really have to do n-body simulations. Okay, so this is our result for the neutrino overdensity around various different kind of halos for different neutrino masses. Okay, so the four panels show four different neutrino mass models. One means one massive species. Three means they're three degenerate species, each with that mass. Okay, so you can see that 2DF alone, we chose this because 2DF, this is sort of the upper bound from the 2DF galaxy survey. I'm not sure, you said 3.6, but I guess that paper said 1.8. Okay, anyway, so that's 1.8. And if you want to take the recent map result, this is about the upper bound, but we heard there's probably some debate about whether it's really here or there. Okay, there's some uncertainty. Right, so the initial value is we started out with the Fermi-Dirac distribution. Okay, and the coder matter halo, the NFW halo, does have a evolution in it that we put in. Right, so let me explain that. So what you see is within each panel, we show the neutrino clustering around different mass coder matter halos. So obviously, it goes up as the halo becomes more and more massive, and that's just because the potential well gets deeper. Okay, so that's the trend here. As we lower the neutrino mass, as you saw, the neutrino free streaming velocity goes inversely proportional to the mass. So they free stream more. So in fact, you can calculate a characteristic scale for which they cluster. So what's happening here is, if you recall the coder matter halos, they look like this, and then they are very cuspy in the inner part. Neutrinos at the outer part do pretty much the same thing as what coder matter is doing. But the very inner part, they are just too hot to cluster. Okay, so this is a characteristic. People knew this, the difference between hot and coder matter, probably at least 10 years ago. Okay, so here we're seeing this flattening due to the different thermal property of hot versus cold dark matter. So when you go to the 0.15 EV model, the clustering becomes less. So now you see, however, the and another thing is the difference between these. We chose these two to demonstrate the difference in the one versus three species neutrino. And you see the clustering is less by about maybe less than factor of two here. But since there are three species of neutrino contributing to the number density, okay, so it actually adds up. So the net effect of the free streaming distance, I mean, it does show up a little bit because these are somewhat hotter. But the key here is what's controlling the potential is the CDM. Right, so that's why three versus one species neutrinos in either the linear power spectrum or clustering here, it's not a factor of three at all. Okay, it's because cold dark matter is the key potential. Yeah, no. All this clustering is occurring at very, very low redshift. But in fact, cold dark matter halos don't even form until probably redshift. Most of these don't form until probably redshift 4, 3, 2, 1, depending on the mass scale. And the neutrinos cluster even later. So in fact, for most of the time, they're free streaming until probably redshift of 1 or ish. Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't do that to the density profile at all. What you need is more of these halos at higher redshift. That's what early reionization will require, is to have early formation of objects. Nothing to do with a profile. Okay, it's the number density that you need. This profile thing is all late-time, highly nonlinear effects. Okay, so having this now, so what we did was we went into the so now we can use this in the Z-burst model. As you see, so this is the top curve is for Virgo scale halos, and the overdensity could be a factor of 50. This is about 200. It's significant. It's not negligible at all. However, when you go to very small halos, neutrinos, as expected, do not cluster much. So we put this result into calculations for the ultra-high energy cosmic rays. Okay, so what we did was we picked five lines of sight towards five of the most massive clusters in the nearby universe. Imagine that cartoon earlier I had. The universe is very highly inhomogeneous. So towards, say, Virgo, seems that neutrinos could be quite overdense relative to the cosmic mean. And then we can calculate the cosmic ray flux from the new bar burst. And here is our prediction for three of the same models. And then we also included this one species delta, assuming delta m square is m square result. Okay. Again, this is so here now I'm plotting the end product of the new Z-burst model for the cosmic ray spectrum. And again, it's flux times EQ versus E. And let's just pick one of the panels. So say upper right. Okay, so these are towards five different lines of sight. So the very lowest curve is assuming there's no neutrino clustering. So this will be towards most lines of sight where neutrino is homogeneous. Okay, so there is delta nu is zero. The top curve, for example, is our prediction towards Virgo. So what we did there was, so what the calculation depends on are two things. One is the distance to the cluster, because after the Z-burst, the proton mass energy loss depends on the distance. Two is the mass of the cluster, as you saw, because the neutrino overdensity differs. So Virgo being massive, in fact, there's the new overdensity contributes, make a significant difference there. If you take Perseus, that's more distant, then Virgo is about 20 megaparsec. Perseus, I think, is on the order of 70 megaparsec.
Are these the protons from the Z decay?
That's right. Anyway. Protons.
That's a fairly small ring.
Beg pardon?
You took the correct branching ratio from the Z particles to the protons.
That's right. Yeah. And then that's, we didn't do the that kind of calculation ourselves. That's well known, given by, yeah, we just used that result. Yeah. Okay, and so you can see, since Percy is further away, you see this, there is some GZK suppression due to the larger distance traveled. Okay, yeah, here we just assume it's highly boosted. Gamma is like 10 to the 11th or something. So we did not put in any magnetic deflection. Although there are recent papers discussing that issue. I think Siegel recently had a paper about that. Okay. And on top of this, again, the same data points you saw earlier is Hi-Rez and Agasta. I should emphasize the overall, this spectrum does not depend on the injection neutrino spectrum much at all. It doesn't depend on the slope because this is a resonant scattering process. So it only depends on very much on the flux at the resonant energy, which I showed earlier. Okay. So the only thing uncertain here is the incident flux of the neutrinos. And here we just by hand normalize that to the same number. Our paper specified that. And we did not bother to fit our normalization to the data point because there's this two sigma discrepancy. I don't know how to which one to fit to. Okay, so this is just to illustrate the difference neutrino clustering can make towards different lines of sight. And you look at the lower right one, as expected, the five lines of sight all made the same prediction because there's hardly any neutrino clustering. Okay, but for this remaining window here, there can be difference, and current data just won't be able to tell the difference. And our prediction is that for these neutrino ranges, there should be some sort of anisotropies toward different lines of sight. One thing to say is, point out is, the currently running Auger experiment is in Argentina. And unfortunately, I don't think they can see Virgo, which is, I think, near the North Galactic Pole. But there is ongoing talk about having a second detector in at the Utah site. And the Northern Hemisphere obviously has a lot of structure that's interesting. So I think that's another reason to have another array in Utah.
So tell me if I understand correctly, for each neutrino mass, these curves, the theoretical curves are just one parameter fit. Right? There's only one parameter in the theory, right? The incoming flux.
That's right.
Only one parameter.
That's right.
Incoming neutrino flux, which you assume to be energy independent, right, over this range.
That's what I say. It didn't matter because the resonance scattering pretty much picks out E at E resonance. So whatever input slope you put in didn't really matter.
But the curves move up and down.
Exactly. Exactly. And that we did, that's just a parameter here. Okay. The last slide I'll show is just the same things here. Okay, but for most of the lines of sight where neutrino clustering is important. When you don't have a huge CDM clump there, neutrinos won't cluster. I mean, it's important that neutrinos are not spontaneously clustered given these masses. They only cluster around CDM. And here's a comparison. It's the same plot again. So this is just the bottom of each panel curve up there from the previous curve. And they have different profiles because the resonant energy occurs at different energy for different neutrino mass. Okay, so even for different neutrino masses without neutrino clustering, the predictions are different. Okay. So I'll just summarize now by saying that obviously I think the Auger experiment will be extremely interesting in pinning down whether there's a GZK cutoff or not. That's still being debated, especially having the two different methods in the same. By the same experimental team, they can calibrate the energy much better. Secondly is, even if the Z-burst model is not, say, at the end of the day, it is not the correct model for GZK events, or if there's no GZK, super GZK event, I think as Tom pointed out in his paper that nu bar scattering, if there is an energetic neutrino source, nu bar scattering is one of the few, is the only way to really have any chance of detecting Rayleigh neutrinos, okay? Because our prediction just says nu bar will go into Z0 and then go to protons. That's just going to happen as long as you have a high energy incident neutrinos. The last thing I'll point out is the method we use using the Boltzmann equation, it should be useful for anybody who wants to calculate any light collisionless particles. It doesn't have to be neutrinos, because we know the universe is dominated by quotient matter. So you don't have to do simulations to follow if you have another, your favorite species of particles zooming around, as long as it's light and as long as it's collisionless. That method, which takes only a few minutes to compute on a laptop, should be applicable.
Okay. What's the
perfect
EEG background?
Okay, that's actually, so what we were doing is just concentrating on the very high, ultra high energy part. And that's the, we are comparing this to the standard extragalactic background sources, which is considered to be one way to explain the sub-GZK regime. Is probably the events are all coming from just extragalactic AGN sources. So if you take a homogeneous population of them, that's nothing new. That's everybody has computed those things. So this is the exact GZK feature I was talking about. Protons originating from extragalactic sources. This is the and that's why some people prefer not calling this the GZK cutoff, because you see this is just a feature. When you go above the resonant energy, you have things coming out. Okay, and this rising curve, they all mean nothing because this has been multiplied by E cubed, obviously. So it's a rapidly falling spectrum. Okay, so I'll end here.
Is there some direct way you can compare your real results with the old Tremaine Gunn bound?
Yes, we actually looked into that. And the Tremaine Gunn bound, the problem with that paper is there's no, the entire potential comes from neutrinos. So their very elegant argument applies only for pure hotter matter problem. So if you try to put in some colder matter, modify their argument, they have upper, I mean, this doesn't exceed that at all.
We asked him a slightly different way. So if these guys were, the neutrinos were bosons instead of fermions, presumably you'd get the exact same answer. I mean, the suppression that you find in the inner region has nothing to do with the statistics. It's just the, right, it's just
the book. Right, if you, the only place I'll change is to change the sign
yeah,
of my,
probably a minor
that's problem. Probably minor. That's probably
the
minor.
The main gun thing I always thought is being due to the fact that neutrinos are fermions, but your suppression in the inner region has nothing to do with the statistics, that's just to do with you know, the fact that they free stream out. So is Tremaine Gunn not Fermi-Dirac argument?
Well, I think that bound is probably valid, but let's see, for it's valid, but it's not relevant, because it's a much higher bound, that what's controlling the clustering at the center is not the phase-space exclusion, although I mean that there's nothing wrong with the argument, it's just not relevant to clustering of neutrinos in colder matter halos.
You're putting fewer neutrinos in than you would if you saturated the Tremaine Gunn bound. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
So you never get the test.
You never get to that point.
But I'm saying
you never fill up the phase-space before the free streaming just washes it out. It's a different argument. Free streaming and Tremaine Gunn are definitely different things.
The neutrino flux normalization you put in, is it conceivable to see those neutrinos are ice
cubed? Yeah, I think we looked into that. No, I think it's still very small, yeah. But another interesting related question is the photons coming out of these models, both at the source and as a Z-burst site, they downgrade to GeV range, and EGRET has very strong bounds on the gamma ray background. And this model, I think, is well known that in our calculation, like the flux we needed for neutrinos, if the source produced comparable photon flux to the neutrino flux we need here, egrep bound would have been exceeded. So the source will have to be relatively photonless. And but since that, yeah.
That's why I'm touching the proton. So if you're confused by, these points you have on the plot, are these protons or photons?
They're protons.
How do they end up being protons?
I mean, we took the branching ratio of nu bar going to Z0.
And that should give you more photons than protons. Z decays more than photons.
That's right, but I think that, I mean, aren't those photons, I think they downgrade very rapidly, right? No.
Not
very much. Okay.
Okay. And in fact, depending on the location of the source, you may have some of the symmetry that these fluxes may be affected by magnetic field, because photons can pair produce all the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if your point like source is in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, you may have some effect on that.
Sure, okay.
This pop curve is sort of way off infinity.
Mm-hmm.
There might be limits on this when this experiment is put in.
Yeah, we looked at that. It was called glue, or glue or something. Yeah. So for the three generation species, that's fine. But when we did the one species for 0.07 EV, because that we require three times as much flux, and that's exceeded. Okay. But we read the papers, and it seems like it was relatively uncertain in their limit. But that's right. So the 0.071, that's exactly what you're saying. This curve, the glue bound would have been exceeded. Yes.
Okay. No further questions. Let's thank you.